The green line is really slow. But it's nice. I just want to thank you so much. It's really, really nice to be here. It's really great to hear Howard speak again. At Fordham, when we had Howard, it was the biggest event we ever had, and he filled the Pope Auditorium, and there were over 350 people. So let's hear it for Howard once more. Before he retired, Dan Berrigan taught in the Peace and Justice Studies program at Fordham. And since I'm the director, I kind of like to say that Dan Berrigan was my faculty member. And since he was there and he was teaching classes about poetry, of course he had, really, students became very dedicated and knew of Dan's work. And they decided to put the play on, The Trial of the Catesville Nine. So they were rehearsing, and of course Dan actually came up and saw it and was very moved. When the students were rehearsing, and the director had these really bad-looking Xeroxed copies, and I said, "What's that?" And they said, "Well, this is the play." And I said, "Well, why don't you have a book or like something that looks like a script or something?" And they said, "Well, there isn't anything like that." I thought, really? So come to find out that the book had been out of print for years. And so I started calling around, and Beacon Press said they weren't going to come out with another copy, that there were other things. So I decided to bring a new edition out from Fordham Press. And, of course, that led to a preface. And then that's when I started to feel like a detective, because I began to trace the effects and the pathway of the play around the globe for the 35 years since it had been written. And it was fascinating. Does anybody know the work of Dar Williams, or the Green Album, and the song I, Daniel Berrigan? It's a wonderful song. So I heard it and I thought, wow. So I really wanted to talk to Dar about why she wrote this song. And sitting in a restaurant waiting for Dar, and I was figuring out that Dar must have been 2 years old when the first Trial of the Catesville Nine was published. So I wondered, what was the motivation? And she said that her parents had it and that the Berrigans were just part of their lives. And then I began to think of other things. Dar had brought with her this piece of yellow-lined paper with carefully written script that someone had written to a friend of a fan who had been in the play in Syracuse in 1968, when all of a sudden, surprising the cast late at night when they're rehearsing, Father Berrigan walks in the room and sits down, and right in the front, for the first time in this edition, is that great picture of Dan in 1968 with the cast all around him, and they were talking about the play. Philip Berrigan was in and out of jail so many times that he didn't even see the play. He missed all of the showings in New York and elsewhere in the States, and he didn't see the play until he was sitting around with West Berliners and it had become the official play of the Green Party. And so there were story after story of people who had performed the play, and that it had touched so many people's artists, directors, producers, poets, and musicians' lives that it was truly wonderful. And of course, my students had the same effect on them. It was my pleasure also at the time to talk to Howard and meet Howard and talk about his role with the Berrigans. And I took the opportunity to make some connections in this book, in an afterword. Since I'm a media critic, I used the words for my own purposes to criticize the media. This came out in 2004, so we had already lived through the selling of the war in Iraq, and we're in the height of the war in Iraq. And so I want to just read to you a couple of ways in which the words in this play were so relevant still to everything that was happening in Iraq those 35 years later. So I'm just going to kind of randomly read a few paragraphs. I won't bore you too much, but During the war in Iraq, television commentators helped convince audiences that military actions and modern weaponry would work better than diplomacy, that war was the only way. There weren't any peace heroes. War is the only way. Retired General Barry McGaffrey is only one of the many ex-generals who was paid on television as an analyst, and he was on MSNBC in March of 2003 as the invasion was occurring, and he openly idolized the weapons of war. And he said, "Thank God for the Abrams tank and the Bradley fighting vehicle. The war isn't over until we've got a tank sitting on top of Saddam's bunker." In addition to his fee from NBC, McGaffrey had other financial interests in war. He sits on the board of Integrated Defense Technologies, a company that in March of 2003 alone received more than $14 million worth of contracts relating to Abrams and Bradley machinery parts and support hardware. The words of Thomas Lewis in the trial of the Catonsville Nine in Baltimore federal court are as true today as they were then. Only the weapon systems have changed. And what Thomas wrote in the trial of the Catonsville Nine, and of course Dan wrote it, and it was printed in the trial. "The Sentinel missile system would not be possible if there were not this war. Who are gaining from the war? They are an elite minority who are very wealthy, but what is happening to the poor in this country? In the 21st century, America is a brave new world where those who profit from weapons are now also paid to persuade the public of the virtue of those weapons." And I want to read a little bit about some of Howard's work. "Those who remember the Gulf of Tonkin resolution were not so easily fooled by the Bush administration's justification for the Iraq war. President Lyndon Johnson was given the power to make war in Vietnam after he announced to Congress that American ships on routine patrol had been attacked. It is now well documented that every element of that claim was false. For the Catonsville Nine, the killing of Vietnam was never justified. In the words of Daniel Berrigan in the play, all of us who act against the law turn to the poor of the world, to the Vietnamese, to the victims, to the soldiers who kill and die for the wrong reasons, for no reasons at all, because they were so ordered by the authorities of that public order, which is in effect a massive institutionalized disorder. As the media celebrated the victory over Iraq with endless replays of the image of Saddam Hussein's statue pulled to the ground, every one of the stated reasons for the war in Iraq began to unravel. The triumphal celebrations overcame war's truths as victories sought to erase public conscience. The picture says something about us as Americans, pronounced USA Today, about the statue coming down, about our can-do spirit, our belief in lending a hand. On Fox News, a Washington Post reporter said, this is one of just like the Berlin Wall, just sort of that pure emotional expression, not choreographed, not staged managed, the way so many things these days seem to be, really breathtaking. Of course, we know that pulling down the statue at Theodore Square was staged by PSYOPs in the U.S. Army. But basking in such glories, it seemed irrelevant that no weapons of mass destruction had been found. CIA Director George Tenet admitted that the agency should not have allowed the president to claim in his State of the Union address that Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. The documents had been forged. But it was Howard Zinn in 2003, a little bit after the war, writing, "The so-called drones of death turned out to be model airplanes. What Colin Powell called decontamination trucks were found to be fire trucks. What U.S. leaders called mobile germ labs were found to be an official British inspection team. The British inspection team, they were used for inflating artillery balloons. Admitting to a profound institutionalized disorder, U.S. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, one of the main architects of the war, explained why it was necessary to make such claims. He stated in an interview with Vanity Fair in May of 2003 that for reasons that have a lot to do with the U.S. government bureaucracy, we settled on the one issue that everyone could agree on, weapons of mass destruction. So those are the kinds of things that we think of when we look at the debates and there's no contestations between the two main candidates and the vice presidential candidate. But the American public are really much smarter than that, and I'm really glad that you talked about that precipitous falling line. The minute that Sarah Palin started talking about that old language that kept us in Vietnam for so long, we can't lose this war. We already lost the war the minute we started it. So it's up to people like us, and it's up to those who get inspired by the works of poets and visionary and peace heroes like the Berrigans and Howard Zinn, to be inspired by that work and continue to have the sense to go against the war, even if our institutionalized disorder that we call our government doesn't really want to carry out the will of the people. Thank you.
Okay.